Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
At the most recent Mensa conference, I was looking through the program for what sessions to attend. And there was one on what is it really like to be an oboist, you know, in an orchestra. And although it sounded boring, nothing sounded better. And I am a musician, so I figured, what the heck. It turns out I was, now pardon the pun, blown away. So I invited the presenter, Lana Lee, onto the show. At age 21, Lana won the Diablo Symphony Young Concerto competition, has gone on to play at the Hollywood Bowl more than once, has done studio work in L.A. playing for a film score. She's played in local orchestras for shows such as Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, and Mary Poppins. And she's just finished a 10-year tenure as the principal oboist of the Contra Costa Chamber Orchestra. And Lana Lee is here to tell us what life as an orchestra member, specifically in her case an oboist, is really like. Lana Lee, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for giving me some of your Thursday night.
Oh, sure. No problem.
Let's start with the basics. Some people may not even know what an oboe sounds like. So can you play just a little bit of a snippet of something for us?
Sure.
Okay.
I got to stand up.
Yeah, stand up. Do it. Great, thanks. Now, before the show, you were messing around with your reeds, you know, a lot, you know, you're playing around with them. And you said to me that oboists tend to be obsessed about their reeds. What do you mean?
So the thing about reeds is, like, if we don't have a reed, we can't play because we require the reed. And I know there's, like, a famous quote from Marcel Tabouteau. He's, like, the grandfather or the father of the American School of Oboe Playing. He said in his 40 years, even he gets anxious about what's going to come out of his reed because he can't predict it. Because the reason why is oboe reeds are very temperamental, much like a three-year-old, like my three-year-old nephew. They're dependent on the weather, humidity. Like, for example, yesterday it was raining, so none of my reeds were working. I had 30 reeds in my box, and the common thing that oboists say is just like, I've got all these reeds and none of them work. I have no reeds to play for tomorrow. And now, so things are very fragile.
I want to test out, you know, this, how, whether this is neurotic or is real, it's realistic to worry. Now, I asked you to bring what you have a box of reeds, like 30 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I asked you to bring what you consider your best reed and the worst reed, but the one that you would still play, not one you would throw out. Can you play the two? And don't tell me which is the good one.
Okay.
Play two little snippets, one with your best read and one with your worst, and let me see if I can guess which is which.
Okay. And just note, it's the best read today because it might be the worst read tomorrow.
Okay, fair enough.
So, yeah. Okay.
Fair enough.
Okay, be right back.
Yeah. She's now putting the read, one, I don't know if it's her best or her worst, she's putting a read into her oboe, and now she's going to play. That sounded great. Okay. I hope that was the good read. We'll find out. Now, I would only say it was a subtle difference. It feels a little harsher, the second one. So I'm guessing that the first one had a rounder sound and it was the better read. Was I right or wrong?
The first one was the worst.
Oh, no!
Worst read.
Oh, and I'm supposed to be using... See, I told you, oboe players are neurotic.
We are. I mean, the thing about reeds is, like, you have to think of it like a horse. For example, the bad reeds... the bad read is like you're trying to break in a wild horse. So even though... The mark of a good oboist is how well you can control the reed. And so, like, I think the second reed is not as stable as the first. Like, if I were to adjust it, you could tell the difference. Versus, like, if you're riding a really nice horse, you're able to enjoy it more, and then you aren't so tired.
So it's not so much that it sounded different, but you had to work harder to play it so that if you were playing something really hard, you might not have been able to do it well with that first reed.
Right. The first reed, it feels like I'm playing a 2x4. So if I were to play longer, I would... just be really tired. I'd probably be slobbering. You know?
Okay, now let's get to the, you know, the show's about career. I wanted to give people a feel for oboe playing, but now, because this show's focused on career, let's focus on career stuff. So what gave you the guts to try to be a professional oboist, indeed spend a fortune on a bachelor's in music from USC?
Well, I just wanted to see if I could do it, because life is about having options and setting limits for yourself. So I just wanted to take my playing to the next level by learning from the right teacher, and that was at USC. That's who I wanted to study with. I mean, I always took lessons in high school, but I wanted to challenge myself, and the way to challenge yourself is to be around better players. Otherwise, you become ambivalent.
So the money net, you know, you didn't think of it like a, you know, a business person, risk-reward ratio of doing that. You said, I want to get better, and I'm going to go and major in music.
Yes, but the thing is, I did the 2-for-1 special. Like, I got my master's in engineering at the same time.
Mm.
So that's why I did it.
Mm.
I mean, if I just did music, then of course, like, you know, coming out of college, I wouldn't be able to, it would be more difficult to pay back my loans.
Yeah, we'll talk about that transition. She actually made a transition from being an engineer to some, she works now in a, she's got a day job and a night job. The night job is as a musician.
Yeah.
And her day job is, she's what's called a community manager. She works for a corporation called Zwora. We'll get to that transition later.
Okay.
But we're focusing here on being an orchestra musician member. What you know, I love listening to music. Going to live music is one of my very favorite things. What might surprise me? Everything seems so well, pardon the pun, orchestrated when I go to and hear an orchestra. What might surprise me about being in an orchestra?
So there's many different types of orchestras that you can play in. Like, you can play on stage, like, you know, the San Francisco Symphony, where everything's formal, everyone's wearing their tuxes. And then you can also play in an orchestra pit. And I kind of prefer to play in the orchestra pit because it's more fun. Like, for example, for Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid, you can just sort of, I hate to say it, but we kind of mess around. We look at our phones even though we're not supposed to. Mm. But the difference is when you're on stage and when you're in the pit is, especially like if you're also playing on a film score, is that there's something called a click track. So the conductor is like listening to the clicks, like it's just like click, click.
Wow.
Like if they have to slow down for the singers because they have to stay in touch with the action.
So the conductor doing his waving of the baton is merely for show when that click track is, the click track is what's really governing everything?
Pretty much, yeah. But usually they create the click track themselves. So at the same time, like they choose their own tempos, but they're strict with their own tempos.
Now, let's turn to that whole issue of, first, let's let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Lana Lee. She is at least a part-time professional oboist and got a day job working as a kind of a manager, not kind of. She is a manager for Zwora, a respected corporation here in the Bay Area. And we're talking, though, what is it like to be an orchestra member? And how does it feel to have ended up, you know, after all that expense and all those years, I'm sure you practiced a lot. You started playing oboe probably when you were 8 or 10 or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how does it feel to have ended up with a day job as a manager in a corporation and freelancing oboe on the side, like at churches, local chamber orchestras that per hour, including your practice time, probably pay you less than minimum wage?
Well, I like having, the thing is, like, one is an escape from the other. So, you know, If we were to do music full time, then it would feel like a job, like the daily grind. So like one is like a vacation from the other, and also it's just nice knowing where the next paycheck is coming from and having benefits. Just the reality of life, realities
of
life.
No matter how much, even, you know, USC is a premier music school, and you're not a kid anymore. You're in your 40s. And you've been doing this now for 30 years, playing for 30 years, invested in private lessons, you practice all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody knows that it's still a struggle, but it's hard to believe. And you won this, you know, at a young woman, you won the Diablo Symphony Young Concerto competition. It's not like you're chopped liver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's amazing.
Yeah, because I remember at USC, because when we're freshmen, we have to take this performance sort of session where people come in and talk to us, and I remember this one guy, he came in, he won the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto competition.
That's the big competition.
Yeah, the number one competition. And he said that, you know, when he won the competition, he was expecting like his phone to be ringing off the hook, people be knocking on his door, and
right.
he said nobody called.
It's You're like, kidding.
He's an even I have to go out and find my job.
Oh.
The hustle never ends.
Oh,
so it's tiring. It's tiring. And especially like, you know, you knowing me, it's like I don't have the hustle personality.
Yeah, you're not a hustling person, right?
No, so it's just like it's difficult. It's a hard life, but it's rewarding at the same time.
We turn back the clock. You're 8 years old. You start playing the oboe again?
I might choose a different instrument. I might have chosen the bassoon.
Why?
Because I think it's nicer. It's a nicer sound. And then the reeds are easier. You don't have to rotate the reeds so much. They last longer.
And would you have gone to USC again and majored in music again?
I liked USC. I might have tried to go to the East Coast, maybe, because, you know, I mean, USC, we consider it the best in the west of the Mississippi, mm-hmm. but East Coast is where you should actually go if you actually want to make a go at it.
Hmm. Well, you know what I'd like to invite my listeners to call? If you have a question about what it's really like to be an orchestra member, an oboist in specific, or simply an orchestra member, whether it be, as Lana was saying, on the stage or in the orchestra pit, as would be the case for if you're playing for a show, a Broadway show or off-Broadway show or whatever, this is a great time to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, Lana Lee is very nice. I'm sure she'll be happy to answer your question. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, originally, you were actually an engineer.
Yes.
So tell me about the transition from that to your day job as a non-engineer in corporate America and as an orchestra musician nights and weekends.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always played music. I was good at math and science, and I got into UC Berkeley, which is my dad's alma mater. And so it was a choice between that or becoming a doctor at Stanford. So I never got into Stanford, so go Bears, you know. So, yeah. And I liked it. I worked there for 15 years.
Wow. And for Fluor Corporation.
That's
a Fortune 500 company.
Yeah, yeah. I worked pretty much everywhere except Bechtel. So you can say that I made it in the engineering world. And I was just ready for something different.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and my guest, Lana Lee. What is your question or comment for her?
Is it myself on the
air? It is you, your very self.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question, and it's sort of a rhetorical or question, cultural question for San Francisco and for you as a person. If people are being paid so little and almost doing voluntary offerings, playing their music, I'm wondering why there can't be more music in the streets, more music offered liberally to make San Francisco a much more cultured place. Like when we think of, you know, New Orleans or other places, Louisville or something like that, why can't musicians come together and make more community offerings? And that might lead to other gigs or other opportunities, but I would love that San Francisco be more attractive and attracting more arts and diverse forms.
Interesting question. Lana Lee, what are your thoughts?
I do notice a difference because I did live in L.A., Los Angeles, for 10 years. That's where I freelanced, and it was just like I had so many gigs. It was great. But then, you know, my father had cancer, so then I moved back to the San Francisco Bay Area, and, you know, it's a little different. A little different up here. I mean, of course, in L.A., like, you're around showbiz and everything like that. You've got studio work.
But her point is about street musicians, that she feels the culture of San Francisco or anywhere is enhanced by, you know, little groups of, like she said, diverse forms. It doesn't matter what the genre is, but at various street corners, like in New Orleans. I think she's making a very interesting point. You normally think of San Francisco as a arts-centric culture.
Is, yeah.
Why do you think there isn't more street musicians doing their thing?
It could be because, you know, I don't normally play on the street, but I think you also need to have a permit, I believe. Or it could just be the increased cost of living. People are trying to make ends meet. Mm. Like there's the whole thing of up here there's a freeway philharmonic where they can just drive like 2 or 3 hours, like just playing in all the orchestras from like Monterey up to Vallejo.
Wow. You mean people who are trying to make a living as an orchestra musician have to go from Monterey to Sacramento, from gig to gig to scrape together a living?
And also
teach, correct?
And then all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, I really love your call. It's a lovely vision. You know, and I do think that as ever fewer jobs are going to pay well, not just music, but almost anybody, unless you're an artificial intelligence programmer of great renown, that we're going to need to find our satisfaction from non-materialistic things. And the notion that all the arts, from visual art to performing art to juggling to magic, where people are getting their joys and pleasures out of things that don't cost, you know, for me to go to Berkeley Rep costs $100 a ticket. You know, that's obscene. You know, they talk about how they're being so pro-worker and pro-the-people and proletariat, and they charge $100 a ticket. But I like your idea, actually, about street musicians. So I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco. You are an honored member of the Work with Marty Nemco workforce. Okay?
Thank you.
You
thank
take
you
care.
So much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
So let's. So you were ready. We were turning back to you. For those of you just joining us, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Lana Lee about what it's like to be a professional orchestra member. But even she, who's won awards and all the rest of it, has got a day job, which she likes. She's, you know, it's not like she's a miserable.
It's so fun.
Right.
Yeah.
She's a manager at a corporation called Zwora. But at nights and weekends, she plays chamber orchestras and church orchestras and in the orchestra pits and things. She's played in the Hollywood Bowl and all that stuff. So. Was it hard to make the transition from being, you were an engineer,
mm-hmm.
was it hard to convince a corporate employer to hire you for something having very little, if anything, to do with engineering for your day job, and yet still have time to be this musician person?
It was difficult because, you know, I have a bachelor's from UC Berkeley, which is a very good school. I mean, of course, I'm partial. I say it's the best, you know. And then I have a master's in engineering. Most people don't go into get a master's unless they really want to do it long term. So it's hard to convince people that I want to have a fun job, that I want to have a job that probably pays less than engineering because I was comfortable as an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the thing is, what I did was I volunteered for community stuff because it's just I enjoy doing it.
Community. There's a definition of community that I didn't even know, but community means. I'll take a minute because I think it's useful for our listeners and understanding the new world of work. Obviously, customer service was something that every company had to provide but hated it because it was a big cost center. Every time somebody had a complaint, the first thing they wanted to do was pick up the 800 number and get some live person on the phone, and that ended up being very expensive because except for the very basic questions where the person answering the phone could have a list of facts, you know, the common questions or whatever, they ended up having to escalate a lot of them, and it was really a pain in the butt. So corporate America came up with this concept called the community, which encourages people to help each other online by answering each other's questions, and people who answer questions get points of various sorts to incent them for doing it. And yeah, if that doesn't work, yes, there's still an 800 number, but that ends up using a lot less resources. And there's a new job title over the last 5 years or so called community manager, the person who's in charge of encouraging users to help each other answer questions. Have I summarized it well, first of all?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and that's your job.
So
in the interview, I'm trying to picture you. Here were you, this engineer and oboist,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to convince the employer at Zwora
mm-hmm.
to hire, or that wasn't your first job, I guess, but, you know, your first job in that space. But how did you try to convince Zwora or wherever that company that you worked for before to hire you for something you had no experience in?
I use my volunteer experience as experience itself, but I also try to come up with ideas.
What volunteer experience?
Like, I did a lot of work for meetup.com.
Oh.
So actually, yeah, they actually wanted to hire me, but I didn't want it to, I didn't want to move to Soho.
Okay.
Because it snows out there.
Ah.
But, yeah, they wanted to hire me, and I also did lots of stuff for nonprofits.
Okay.
So I use that those transferable skills. And I also try to show them just how I think, like coming up with ideas, because anyone can do the tactical, but the strategic stuff, you either have it or you don't.
My trusty board operator engineer, Joanne Marr, did some research while we were talking, and she came up with this about the oboe. And she wants to get your reaction about it. Her punchline and question is, does my guest feel that's an unfair stereotype? So I'm going to read you what was written.
Okay.
The oboe is one of the most challenging instruments to play. It's a double reed instrument. A single oboe reed lasts about a month or 12 to 15-ish hours, and each reed costs $20 to $40 to replace. Oboes are fragile, temperamental instruments, and are easily knocked out of tune by cold, heat, moisture, and the slightest of bumps. They must be handled with maniacal care. As a result, it is said that oboe players tend to be detail-oriented, obsessive people. It is said that this type of personality is required to play the oboe well. The negative stereotype about oboists is that they're anal retentive. That's great, Joanne. Thank you so much. Does my guest feel that's an unfair stereotype?
No, it's all true. It's all true. Like, you know, because I remember I had to play Sound of Music outside, and I was just like, my poor oboe. It's like my child, you know. And once I dated this guy, he wanted me to put my oboe in the trunk while we went in to eat. And I was like, would you put your child in the trunk? No.
Wow. It's like,
because, like, heat or dryness, or it can make the oboe crack.
Okay.
And then it'll
really
be
well.
And then it'll be worthless.
Wow. How much does your oboe cost?
It's about $4,000 or $5,000. Well, like, it's probably depreciated since I bought it.
Okay. But, like, okay. And so is that considered a top-level oboe?
Yeah, it's a professional oboe.
Okay. So yeah. A student oboe would be $100. And what if I'm the principal in the San Francisco Symphony, am I playing that kind of $4,000 oboe? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. What advice do you have? Let's say somebody is an aspiring professional orchestra member. Maybe make it oboist in specific.
Mm-hmm.
What advice do you have for an aspiring professional oboist?
I would say it's okay to shoot for the moon, but have a parachute in case you miss. So, like, you know, my Asian dad would say, is just like, you know, it's okay to try. It's okay to try, but, you know, major in something else where you can earn a living, because I don't want to support you for the rest of your life.
Sounds,
you know,
like my mother and father.
So it could be like music education. It could be business, like even managing your own finances, or like trying to understand the stock market or something. Something that's viable and sustainable.
Did you listen to your father's advice?
I should probably say mother, because my dad wasn't too happy about me going into music. Because
okay.
I left his dream job. So.
No, it would be wrong for me to end with anything other than asking you to play another bit of something on the oboe. What do you want to play? Play like a, you know, 30-second snippet or something.
Something from Bizet.
Okay, what is it?
Symphony in C.
It's not Carmen. The only thing I know about Bizet is Carmen.
Okay, it's the Symphony in C.
Okay, hopefully you're not going to play the whole symphony.
No.
Okay, play a snippet for us. She's getting herself ready, playing with her reeds, massaging them, meditating on them, praying to them. Okay.
You're praying, yeah.
Lana Lee, I told you, dear listeners, I did it in the promo, I never do this, but I couldn't imagine in a million years that there would be an interesting segment on Work with Marty Nemco about what's it like to be an oboist in an orchestra, but I hope you think that my judgment was vindicated. Lana Lee, you did a great job.
Thank you so much
for being my guest on Work with
Sure.
Marty Nemco. Awesome. Okay. And now, as usual, you know, while I do enjoy these interviews that aren't directly related to most of you, my dear listeners, I do recognize my obligation primarily is to you, to help you with your work life. Because even though we have the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years, there are many people who are underemployed, who have given up, and therefore not counted among the unemployed. So my real central goal here in this, my pro bono work here on the radio, is to answer your questions. If you are unhappy with your work life, and it doesn't have to be you, it could be a relative, your child, grandchild even, a spouse, sibling, boyfriend, girlfriend, but the only common denominator is they got to be unhappy with some aspect of their work life. And they're looking for a little help. The price is certainly right. Zero, zippo, nada. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, for what I call a workover. No pummeling involved, usually. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, I like to talk about trends. And because, you know, everybody knows about the same old careers. But I need to give you, my listeners, an edge in the job market of 2019 and beyond. And I have been struck by the progress that has been made in 3D printing. In this last year alone, there's been a ton, and this is a growing... I used to think it was silly. It was going to be these little maker fair where you make these little stupid plastic items, and terrorists can make these little plastic guns out of a printer. Hey, it has gone so far beyond that. How about a bridge? Already made, to be installed in Amsterdam next year is a bridge that was made by a 3D printer. It was made in a few months. Compare that with the Bay Bridge that took, I don't know, was it 3 years, 4 years to build the Bay Bridge? I don't know. A long time. Okay? How about a house? I remember a few years ago, MIT was playing around with seeing if they could 3D print a house. Well, it's left the university. It's in the practical world. A company called Icon says it can make a 650-square-foot house in 12 to 24 hours using a printer. It was the home was just demonstrated at South by Southwest, you know, that the big conference and fair in Austin this October, and they just got $5 million in more funding to expand. So this is no joke. Lest you think that 3D printing is the realm of just the startups, BMW just passed its 1 millionth component that it made for its expensive cars, specifically a window guide rail for the BMW i8 Roadster made on a 3D printer made by a regular HP 3D printer. Company estimates it's going to complete over 200,000 3D printed parts this year alone. How about, let's see, I got one more for you. Right. Using 3D printing, University of Washington researchers created objects such as pill bottles or prosthetics, you know, artificial limbs or whatever, or braces, that can send information on how those objects are being used without the need of batteries. There are antennas embedded in the 3D printed objects which get activated when the object is moved in a specific way. So, for example, like when a pill bottle is opened, or the way somebody is using a brace or moving, and the signal can get sent to a health practitioner in case, let's say, for example, somebody's supposed to take medication and the bottle hasn't been opened in 5 days. 3D printing is one, it's not the only, of course, but it is one of the many growth industries. And I always like to stress, you say, you know, I'm sure many listeners here are not engineers, are not materials engineers, and they're saying, what does it mean for me? Every company that develops this stuff has a human resources department, has a customer service community department, has an accounting department, has a sales department. So when I talk about trends that are high tech, even if you're not high tech, that's where the growth is. Yes, you can't be ignorant about the technology, but any reasonably intelligent person could do a little bit of studying in that area, and if that kind of concept turns you on, you'll at least know enough about that world that when you apply for the job in accounting or human resources or the community or whatever, you won't sound like an idiot, and that way you can get into on the ground floor of a growing industry rather than something that's dying like retail. Okay, I'll give out the phone number again, then we're going to go right to the phones. The phone number here, if you have a work-related problem of any sort, my job here is to help you. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hey there.
Hi.
I'm an RN. I've been an RN for about 13 years, mm-hmm. most of it spent in acute care, inpatient hospital settings.
Mm-hmm. Tough.
Which is exhausting.
Yep.
And stressful.
Yep.
And it's rewarding in certain ways, but it's challenging.
No question.
More recently, I've gone to doing home health, and I mm-hmm. enjoy that a lot more.
Sure.
But there's trade-offs. You're working full-time. You're spending more or less all day, every day in traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And
impossible.
I am mid-50s now. Mm-hmm. This is my second career.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just exploring, you know, what else is there for me? I've kind of explored both those avenues. They have some pluses and minuses, but neither is really, you know, the great fit for me.
There are so many great options for nurses. I want to just share one with you that I think is
okay,
particularly under the radar and avoids you doing the direct patient care, which is what's the big source of burnout. And that is being a legal nurse consultant. We are unfortunately in the era of massive litigation where doctors and hospitals and even assistants are being sued for malpractice or whatever. Law firms are overwhelmed with claims for such malpractice, and they can't and don't want to spend the time, they don't have the expertise to spend the time to triage, pardon the medical pun, to triage all of those claims. So they hire nurses to review the files and say which are worthy and say to Mr. or Ms. Lawyer, this case seems like it's worthy, you should talk with this particular complainant. How do you feel about the idea of being, and it's especially relevant because you have been, you know, many of these are about elders. Elders are much more vulnerable to crap happening. An error can be made with a young person and the person is resilient and will do fine and there's no lawsuit. But if you're 85 and you've got all kinds of comorbidities and now the nurse or the doctor or whatever screws up, that can have a devastating impact. So you're having been a home health nurse as well as doing med surge would put you in an excellent position to do this important non-direct patient care work. To what extent do you find that interesting and not?
Well, I like it a lot. It sounds like it would be challenging and interesting and in a relatively high level mentally.
Yep.
The flip side is that direct patient care is one of the parts of the job that I enjoy the most.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of a trade-off there.
Great. Let me come up with another one. Let me come up with another under-the-radar one for direct patient care.
Okay.
Now, maybe it's because I'm looking at Joanne Marr, who's just done an amazing series on end of life and talking about the importance of palliative care and hospice care.
Yeah.
But if you like direct patient care, I believe, you know, I've spoken to hospice nurses, and they actually are not as stressed out as I would think. I get grossed out at end-of-life issues. But they, because you're not necessarily trying to restore somebody to 100% perfect health, some of the stakes are lower, and it's a more spiritual job. It's a more emotional, comforting job. Had you thought about doing hospice work or, you know, other kind of palliative care work?
Well, a big part of my job involves a lot of palliative interaction. And yes, I have thought about that.
What makes you reject? What makes you have not gone that route and called me instead?
Well, frankly, one of the things I like the patient care part. The part I like least is the charting.
Of course, every doctor says that to me. I have I teach in a medical school at UCSF. I can't tell you how frustrated the doctors are with how much paperwork and how little exams.
Yes.
I just spoke yesterday to this guy's a doc at Kaiser. And he says he loves the patient interaction, but he's spending 70% of his time on paperwork. And that's at Kaiser, which supposedly has become so much more efficient. And, you know, you would think there'd be less than, for example, at a Blue Cross Anthem system. Yeah, the paperwork makes anybody crazy.
And from what I gather, I haven't explored this deeply, but the charting is significantly more in hospice work.
Really?
At least in home hospice. Now, I don't know if there is... I came from a part of the country where there's inpatient hospice, and that was very attractive to me. But now that I'm back in California, people are like, what? No, there's no such thing as inpatient hospice. People do that at home.
Is it worth verifying? I mean, my mother at 90 was in hospice, in home hospice.
Yeah.
And basically all the nurse did was came, took her vitals, made sure she was taking medications, made her comfortable in the bed, whatever, chatted with her for 10 minutes. I can't imagine there would be that much charting in this case. I may be completely wrong. I have an N of one. I have no interaction with this.
This may be the first time ever, Marty.
Yeah, sure. Okay, never mind. Let me try one more. I don't want to let you go because I think nursing is one of the best careers because it's got so many variations in options of what you can do in settings.
Of course.
Let's start with, are you interested in staying in San Francisco? Are you in San Francisco or thereabouts?
I'm in the East Bay, yeah, and I'm a native. My family's all here. I'm here, yeah.
Okay. And you want to stay in this general area?
Yes.
How about, I mean, there are clinics to serve low-income people, like Clinica de la Raza, I think, if I have it right, is in Oakland.
Yep.
Given that you like direct patient care, had you thought about working at one of the, you know, there's also the Berkeley Free Clinic, the long-standing Berkeley Free Clinic on Durant. Had you thought about working at one of these low-income clinic places?
I actually have done some volunteer work at some places like that, and that's about the appropriate thing because the staffers might as well be volunteers. Those people are just ridiculously underpaid. I mean, you can't afford to live in this area on what they pay there.
One more shot.
Okay.
I'm grateful. I just had my annual wellness exam, and it was perfect. I got a clean bill of health. It was great. And although my doctor saw me, a lot of the work gets done by nurses under doctor supervision. But it serves a largely middle class population and this office, and so it's not crazy, it's not overwhelming, it's not like an ER or the stress of med surg. Had you thought about trying to get a job in a physician's office or, you know, a nurse practitioner's office where you're working under the nurse practitioner or a physician?
I have. Again, the clinic positions are underpaid. Nurses in
I'm not talking about a clinic
offices.
Now. I'm talking about somebody who's through Sutter Health, you know, or
right.
Stanford Health, excuse me.
Well, they call those clinics.
Okay, all right.
So, yeah, those people just get paid less.
One more shot.
Nurses get paid more.
Every time. Okay, so money is a matter to you. Okay, so where the money is, there's...
If it was easy, I wouldn't have to call you.
That's cool. Well, I love the challenging questions. You see, I'm a pit bull. I really want to be helpful. So... I'm hearing money and direct care being the primary drivers from what I'm hearing from you, but not the stress of med surg in a hospital. Got it.
Right.
So when I think about who's making the money in this space, it would be, for example, in rehab facilities or in plastic cosmetic surgery places. That's where there's money in physical therapy, you know, physical therapy centers, or the real money really is, for better or worse, in cosmetic surgery places. And also, the beauty of cosmetic surgery is that nearly every patient comes out happy. Because, you know, and so had you thought about, since money is central to you, you don't want the stress of med surg, had you thought about investigating the world either of rehab clinics, as in physical therapy centric places, or cosmetic surgery places?
You know, I haven't really. I've known a few people that have gone into that, and it is quite lucrative, and I've never really felt the pull, but I'll take another look.
I want to tell you one real story I know of somebody who was in her 50s and was always beautiful and was starting, and she was in a very powerful position in her work life. And of course, we live in Silicon Valley in a very youth-oriented culture. And she was reaching the point where she was perhaps fearing either both perception and potentially reality that she was looking a little not fresh enough. And so she went and she got a full facelift, which made her look, I saw her before and after the surgery, she looked truly 12 years younger. Looked like she was 43. She gained confidence that exuded through her every day, and she was she had 10 days later, she was back to work. This was not like, and so she was doing somersaults over her cosmetic surgery.
Right.
Now, I'm aware of the politics of many listeners that say, why are we wasting resources on cosmetics? But, you know, in the same way as people go into psychotherapy for years to try to improve their self-esteem, this woman improved her self-confidence as well as simply literally looking better every time she looked in the mirror, which some people don't get from years of psychotherapy. So lest you too prematurely... You said you didn't really feel a pull. I was telling you this story as an example of how you could potentially, A, make the money you say you're looking for, B, have less stress than in med surg, C, still be in direct patient care, and help people. What do you think?
Very compelling.
I do my best. Okay. I'll quit while I'm ahead. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. So, if you want me to try to be a pit bull with you, whatever your work problem, I really like to hear your problem. I've been doing this 29 and a half years now, so if I can't help you now, I never will. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for workover. Whatever your work problem is, whether you're 16, 46, or 76, there's usually at least a baby step forward. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I really like to focus on what's upcoming. I had a client today, I actually mentioned him without by name, of course, last week, and he came back again for another session today, and he reminded me of something that I had heard was a big trend. He had had an interview with Fidelity. But he was interviewed for Fidelity. Not only was the interview on a webcam, which these days is old news, but what I have seen as an accelerating trend, and it was true of his interview with Fidelity, is that the questions were asked on video. So he was looking at what is like the equivalent of a YouTube video. There was no live person asking the questions. Why? I asked human resources people about this in about a year ago. They said there is fear of lawsuits from women and people of color saying that there were subtle differences in the way the questions were asked, or even very big differences in the way questions were asked. And so to avoid any possibility of there being racism or sexism, both in the questions asked or the tone of how they're asked, they have the interviewer record the questions, even though it means obviously you can't get to nuance and there's less chemistry, and it's obviously hard for people to be relaxed when you're being asked to interview by a robotic-sounding interviewer. But that is a trend, dear job seekers. If you are in a position where you're going to be doing interviews, this is not true with startups or small companies. They don't have the money for that. And they, you know, people don't tend to not sue the startups because they don't have deep pockets. But if you're interviewing for a job at a big company or a big nonprofit, it may increasingly be that you will be, at least the first interviews, will not only be on webcam or phone, but they will be in which you are being interviewed by a video, in which they ask the question, then they tell you to press stop or pause. You answer the question, and then you press start again. You need to prepare for that and manage somehow to not only be, you know, relaxed and substantive, but to somehow create the chemistry that ends up often being the difference between an also-ran candidate and a candidate who gets the job. You've got to look, and there's these are little tricks. First of all, you need to look right above the lens in the camera, not at it, because when you're looking at it, it's too direct. But if you're looking slightly up, your chin is slightly raised, and that makes you appear more confident. It's silly. It's shallow. This is the world we live in. Appearances matter. So looking just above, maybe 1 inch above the lens, will give you a better look. And then pretend, and this is something they've told TV anchors all the time, pretend you're making love to the camera. You're looking deeply into the eyes of that lens or just above that lens and trying to pretend you're having your first or even your second beer with that lens, or you're making love to that lens. You're talking as humanly as if you were having a friendly conversation. Not your fifth beer, but your first or your second, having a friendly, open conversation, or even further, as I said, making love, you know, really eyes open, you know, to the camera. As crappy as that is, I despise, and that's too strong, I dislike having to tell you that this is the world in which we are living in, and where so much hiring is done based on this kind of irrelevant crap. But, and I'm not saying it's ubiquitous at all. They do a lot of tests, you know, for example, for programming jobs, they give you coding tests and whatever. I'm well aware of that too. But the real mega trend that I am seeing that is, not, that's a lie too, not mega trend. The trend I am seeing that is a change from a year, 2, 3 years ago is an increased tendency to not only use webcam interviews, but to use video for asking the questions to ensure that, above all, there is no racism and sexism in the questioning. I thought you might want to know that. While I'm on the interviews, I do have a question. I would give out the phone number again. If you've got a work-related problem and want to ask me a question, the phone number here, Work with Marty and Emco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One more point I wanted to make about interviews. Of course, evermore, and again, one of the other megatrends that's been existing now for 20 years has been the tendency toward group decision-making, collaborative decision-making. It used to be one person interviewed you and they said yes or no, and that was the end of it. No longer. Now there's a series of 3 to 5 interviews, normally with a panel. And the three, again, it's an attempt to avoid making the wrong decision, because today, if somebody, they make a wrong decision, it is really hard to get rid of that person, even if they're incompetent. The risks of lawsuits are enormous. So they've got 3 to 5, tend to be very commonly 3 to 5 interviews, and not with one person, but because of the collaborative, the decreased hierarchy in the workplace and the flattening, we want people to have investment and group decision making. So when you're getting a group interview, there is an art. The art is when you're asked a question And I know this seems mechanical, but again, it's unfortunate, but it's what works. And my job here is within the bounds of ethics to help you succeed. And that means when you're being asked a question by, obviously only one person is going to ask you a question, you look that person in the eye, you wait 1 second so that you're not seeming like you're prepared, too prepared for the answer. That also acknowledges that you're thinking about it and taking that seriously. And then you turn to the person who, of the, say, there's three or four interviewers, to the person, to the panel, the person at the far left. And you start your answer by talking to the person to the far left for about a second or two. Then you turn to the person next to him or her, and you continue your answer for the next second or two. And then to the person to his or her next, left or right, whatever, and give your answer for 1 or 2 seconds to them. And then when you reach the end, you simply reverse field. That makes each panelist feel you are paying attention to them, and they won't notice you're doing it. They'll just say, wow, this person relates well. That's the world of today's interviews. You know, yes, you have to be substantively competent, but this crap also matters a lot. Let me see. Joanne is writing me a note. I can't quite read it. I can't. Something about wait a minute. Who's? Why don't you bring it in here? I can't see it. Who is evaluating those? Anyway, Joanne has got another question. I want to read it, but I can't read it from that distance. She was using a very light pen. Here it is. Thank you. Who's evaluating these video interviews? There could be racism or sexism in the evaluations. That's true. You know, it is impossible, you know, but usually, as I said, these days there is an HR person to try to minimize the racism and sexism. There is a group decision-making process in which it's usually diverse. So, there's no question that racism and sexism has been raised to high, high priority among the criteria that are used in hiring. Race and gender, we live in the era of race, gender, sexual orientation, and class. There is no question about that. Okay, moving off of that. Now, about the phone number again, if anybody has a question about their work life, want me to try to help, the phone number 415-841-4134. What's that, the number for? That's the number for what I call a work over here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. I want to talk now about, there are some people, haven't you ever met somebody who seems good at nearly everything? Sure, they probably have a high IQ, which means they learn quickly, they retain, they apply knowledge in creative ways to solve a wide array of problems. But IQ is relatively immutable. And by the way, if you need data on any of this stuff, I'm more than happy to send. Just email me, and I have data for any kind of assertion that would be based on data. I'm happy to. It's not good radio for me to do citations. But if you're interested in the citations, you can email me at mnemko, that's M as in Mary, N as in Nancy, E-M as in Mary, K-O, at comcast.net. But IQ is relatively immutable, very stable over a lifetime. And pop psych concepts such as grit and growth mindset have been found, I'm going to be polite here, to have less utility than their conceptualizers that claim. They're going to have links to those if you want. So I want to share with you what is a more likely approach to getting good at most things. I've developed this 4-step plan for tackling tasks, a wide range of tasks that apply to many, many tasks that my many highly successful clients and my friends and, okay, I tend to use. I'm going to present it with an example. I originally wrote this as an article in Psychology Today, and so the example I'm going to use is of a person who's trying to learn how to deal with their anxiety. And I'm going to share the 4-step model, but I want to prioritize you, my dear listener, so I'm going to go right to the phones instead. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question about pay equality for contractors. Mm-hmm. I contract with a large tech company
right
here in the Bay Area, and I gave my wage requirements when I got the job 2 years ago,
mm-hmm,
and they said, okay, And so that's what I've been getting paid hourly.
Okay.
And recently the company, my team decided to hire a few other contractors. And so I suggested my boyfriend and he got hired.
Mm-hmm.
When they asked him about his wage requirements, he said a much higher number.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's getting paid $15 an hour more than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And when I approached my supervisor about it, mm-hmm. she said, well, that's because you're in a different category, different job category, because he's a flex employee and I'm a permanent part-time employee, but we do the exact same job.
Mm-hmm. I can't,
and,
yeah, this is a really, these are the most difficult calls for me to take. You notice I'm not shy about rendering an opinion, but apples are not apples. I have clients who do the same job, who might be, I'm just, you know, in customer service, and they may be doing the exact same job, but one may be either much better at it, or have more tenure, or was hired at a time where there was a shortage and therefore got higher wages, or the trend. For example, I've seen in the world of artificial intelligence, as it's become the hottest thing in the world, that today salaries for programmers in TensorFlow are much higher than they were 2 years ago. And when they already, somebody is an existing employee, they always pay more to try to entice somebody to come than an existing employee. So yes, I know you're saying it's, you know, talking about pay equity, that it's sexism, but it's too complicated a matter for me to simply say, you go, girl, those sexist pigs, you fight and go to the EEOC. I can't, because there's just too many other covariates that affect things. Now, if having explored all of those covariates, you really still believe it's sexism, then yes, there are state and federal agencies where you can file a claim if your HR, if your complaint to HR has gone nowhere. Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree with you, and I haven't fully explored it, but I was wondering whether I should go over my supervisor's head, so to speak, and speak directly to HR about it.
The first step is to look inward. I gave you kind of an inventory, a checklist, a report card. Since you're in a very specially advantageous position, and you have this boyfriend who's got the same job as you do, so ask yourself. You know, two people could say they work full time. One person ends up working more hours than the other. Somebody could say, I'm competent, but one could be much more competent than the other. One could be faster. In other words, for a given, let's say, coder, could knock out a particular subroutine in 2 hours, and another could take 6 hours. Somebody else could be a high maintenance and difficult to deal with. Another could be easy. There's just so many factors. And there is the date of hiring. Is there been a trend where the salaries have gone up for your position? You need to look at yourself first on each dimension and ask yourself whether the goddess, who is all-seeing, all-knowing, and fair-minded, would say you are being treated significantly. You know, you can't argue about an hour, a dollar, or two an hour, but you're saying 16. Would the goddess say that you are, relative to your merit, grossly underpaid because of your gender? If so, you've now done the homework that you can go to HR and say, look, point by point, not only do I have the same job title, but I'm as good a programmer, I work as hard, I'm as efficient, my productivity is as good, and I'm still paid way lower. What can you do about it? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. I'll just give out the phone number one more time. No, I don't. We only got a couple of minutes left. I wanted to finish this. I promised that I was going to share with you this notion about how to get good at nearly anything. And I developed a four-step model. Nothing works for everything, but it's a useful template, a useful paradigm to put into your toolkit when you say, I want to get good at X. This can be a very time-effective way to get good at X. Step one, do what I call a time-effective Google search. We tend to take Google for granted because it's free and instant, but it curates millions of resources, visual, that is video as well as text. So in this case, the example I was giving, as I said, I originally published this model in Psychology Today, and the example I used was for a person who had anxiety and was trying to deal with it. So you would start by Google searching the term anxiety, or if the person is anxious in specific contexts like social anxiety or test anxiety, they would use those search terms. Then they would scan the top few results for both articles and videos. Google usually does a fine job of curation because it top ranks the web pages for a given search term that are the ones that are most read, most forwarded, most backlinked. And then you just click, if you look at the search results, click on any search results that feel like they're worth a look, an intuition on your part. And you start by skimming. If it's feeling valuable, keep going. Maybe even reading more slowly. But if it's not very helpful, cut your losses. Many people fail to get the most from their Google searching time by spending too much time with suboptimal articles and videos. Remember that Google searches millions of sources. Usually you needn't settle for just okay. Learn what you can from glancing at your first search's results and maybe one or two or three of its top-ranked articles or videos. And if you need more or better information, just that little glancing is going to often yield a more on-target search term to do another search, or maybe the author of an article, you say, this guy or woman is great, I'm going to contact that person again. I'm going to look search on that person's name. Now, I am well aware that there are certain types of people, I call them ducks in a row type people, who may resist relying on just a few articles or videos. Of course, sometimes deeper knowledge is required, but I have been struck by how often, even regarding a complicated topic, we reach a point of diminishing returns after just a bit of reading. That's what I mean by time effect of Google search. Step two in my four-step paradigm is to do what I call low-risk experiments. Let's say your Googling identifies a variety of approaches to dealing with anxiety. Again, that's the thing we're trying to learn, this person's trying to learn about here. Unless you're confident that those approaches won't work, and so you need to jump to, for example, a pharmacological approach, say an SSRI, try one or more of the low-risk actions you unearth from that Google search for maybe exercise, thought-stopping, journaling, talking with a trusted friend, a good listener, and then continue with those approaches that are helpful and toss out the others. Step three, break it down to baby steps. Let's say you want to try to practice thought-stopping. The baby steps might be, one, write one or more situations that tend to make you anxious. Two, come up with what will be calming in those situations. For example, let's say you get anxious when you get a pain of ambiguous origin. You might write, my doctor says that as long as it's not scary painful, most pains go away within a day or three. There's little risk in waiting, so I need to make myself redirect to something productive. And step three, reduce that spiel to a mantra like, not dangerous, distract. And use that whenever you feel that pain. And the fourth step is know when it's time and cost-effective to outsource. If low-risk experiments fail and you sense they'll continue to be inadequate, it's time to either give up if you can or consult someone. Yeah, it could be a friend or a family member, but perhaps a professional. And of course, that's true whether it's a mental health issue, a physical health issue, or for that matter, a home repair issue. And you just consider your track record. For example, I have a terrible record of trying to fix things around the house, so I'm going to very quickly assess that it's worth calling in the electrician, plumber, whatever. Of course, no goal that is as broad as getting good at nearly anything can be reduced to a four-step plan, but there's little risk in trying it. After all, it's an example of one of the aforementioned tips. It's a low-risk experiment. That four-step plan, that experiment, is one that has been helpful to many people. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. My thanks to my border operator, Joanne Marr, and of course to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, are you burned out? I'll ask you 23 questions to identify your personalized baby steps up from the pit. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.